small game like.
Chair Murphy. I call the meeting of the House Environment Finance Division to order. A quorum is present. Members, please take your seats. And Representative Fabian, have you reviewed the minutes?
I have, Mr. Chair. I would move the minutes to January 29, 2019.
Representative Fabian moves. Any discussion? All those in favor?
Aye.
Aye.
Opposed, nay. Ayes have it. Minutes are approved. Members, we have some very important people here today. The head of the Metropolitan Council and the commissioner of DNR are here, and I know they both have places to go. Before I introduce former Mayor Slawik, I want to remind people we had the tourism presentation last week. There will be a tourism legislative reception Monday, February 4th, 2019, from 5 to 6:30 p.m. at the Minnesota State Capitol, where you can learn more about tourism. It's in the vault room on level B, and there will be hors d'oeuvres. So, hope to see you there. Trying to think if there's any other things we will start. I want to call you Mayor Slawik, but I know that's now I have to call you Chair Slawik, correct?
Yes.
So, Chair Slawik, would you like to introduce yourself and proceed?
Yes. Thank you, Chair Hansen, and to the committee. Appreciate the opportunity to be here. I see some familiar faces and some new ones, so good to be here with you. I've served, my name's Nora Slawik, and I'm the chair of the Met Council, first of all, and I've served in the East Metro as a local elected official for most of the past 20 years. I was the mayor of Maplewood for 5 years, and in that capacity, I chaired the policy advisory committee for the Rush Line, as well as served on the Gold Line, as well as worked on our comp plan. And as a state representative, I served for 7 terms, starting in 96 with Arnie Carlson, also served terms under Ventura, Pawlenty, and Dayton. So more used to sitting on that side of the table than this side of the table just yet. I also have firsthand experience working with the Met Council as I was a member of the TAB, the Transportation Advisory Board, and I bring a unique perspective with my background. And so I understand the importance of the council to every community in our region and the importance of working collaboratively with local leaders, with state representatives, and to find shared solutions. One thing is I really worked on problem solving in Maplewood, and as a state representative, you know how hard you all are working on that. And getting to help people was one of my favorite parts of those positions. I believe in servant leadership. You know, Governor Walz is big on servant leadership, and as you're out there knocking on those doors one by one, it's a lot of problem solving and servant leadership that happens with that as well as our roles. And last, embracing One Minnesota is part of my philosophy, and that's making sure everyone is part of solving those challenges and making sure everyone has a seat at the table. If you don't know, Governor Walz specifically wanted a mayor to be the head of the Met Council. All 3 finalists for the position were mayor. He believes that as a mayor, I'll have the vision and the background working on things like comp plans, environmental issues, transportation issues, housing, those types of things. Last, I just want to talk about my 3 main priorities. First, we need to focus on our region's economic competitiveness, looking at likewise regions, Denver, Seattle, Atlanta, Boston, even strengthening our work with businesses for our economic competitiveness. We're involved with the Itasca Project. We're also involved in many different partnerships with the St. Paul Chamber, as well as the Minneapolis Chamber. But it's about more than just business. Our economic competitiveness is about being a region where people not only can live, work, and raise a family, but a place where people want to live, work, and raise a family. It's also about mobility and being able to get to work or school, have housing that's affordable, great parks, and strategic infrastructure, which is part of what you're going to hear about today, as well as smart plans for the future. This is something the council plays a critical role in. Secondly, we need to ensure that our region is a place where all people, not just some people, can be prosperous. So I want to continue the council's focus on equity, Community prosperity means everyone is benefiting, and we have a lot of work to do in that to close the disparities. And we know they exist in employment and housing and in poverty. Third, I want to make sure we embrace the Walz-Flanagan vision of One Minnesota. This means not just saying we believe in partnership and collaboration, but making sure we're practicing that each and every day in everything we do at the council. Our future depends on all of us coming together to tackle our shared challenges. This means across all communities with other state agencies and even with our own agency. So I'm going to leave because I do have other commitments, but I want you to know, Mr. Chair, and to the rest of you, our door is open and the council looks forward to working with you. Thank you.
Thank you. Chair Slot, could I ask one question?
Yes, of course, Mr. Chair.
Where are you at with the appointments for the rest of the council, if you could just...
Good question. So we're right in the middle of the process. We had people apply, and then that's been narrowed down to 5 for each of the 16 districts. And then we're having 4 regional meetings. So the first one was up in Blaine the other night, and I have to tell you, we have people that have applied that'll knock your socks off. They're incredibly qualified, as well as bring the diversity of perspective that we need at the council. The second one was in Oakdale, and it was last night, but guess what? It got canceled, right? Because we can't have people coming out in 30 degrees below. So that has been rescheduled, and the other 3 are February 11th, February 12th, and February 13th. So if you're interested in coming, we can get you details on that. But I think we have a good group. We have mayors that have applied, and you know that's conflicting interests, so they would have to actually resign their seats if they're chosen. We have, of course, activists. We have people from all walks of life. But really at the council, we're looking for people that represent their regions and their districts well, and I think we're going to find those people. But interested in your input, we've gotten some letters of recommendation from several of you, so we'll continue to take those as well.
Great. Any other quick questions? Thank you, Chair.
Okay. Thank you.
Yep.
Good afternoon. My name is Lisa Thompson. I'm the General Manager of Environmental Services. And I'm happy to be here to give you an overview of environmental services, if I can get this to work. I want to work with one of the 4 divisions of the Metropolitan Council, and we're also going to hear from my peer here, Lisa Barajas, who's going to give a parks overview.
Okay. Proceed. Welcome.
Thank you. Environmental Services has 3 primary roles to fulfill its mission in the region. First of all, we provide wastewater services to municipal and industrial customers, but we also support good planning and provide technical assistance for both surface water planning and water supply planning. The color-shaded areas on this map show where each of our 8 wastewater treatment facilities provide service. We carry out the mission with a workforce of about 600 employees that include skilled crafts, scientists, technicians, planners, and engineers, to name a few. We maintain and operate $7 billion of assets to provide service to 109 communities and actually about half of the state's population and growing. The green area is served by the Metro Plant, which is also our oldest facility and the precursor to our system today. There are 3 chapters in our history that took us from the situation in the upper left picture, where sewage was dumping into the Mississippi River, to the far right results, where we've become designated as a national river and recreation area. The first chapter sets the stage for this state to be an example to other states by turning around the threat to public health and the environment caused by increasing volumes of sewage dumping into the river and being held in place by the lock and dam system. At that time, Minneapolis and St. Paul formed a partnership and jointly built the Metro Plant, and it began operation in 1938, the first major wastewater facility on the Mississippi. That plant can continue to operate and improve and expand even prior to the creation of the Clean Water Act and the establishment of EPA, which came into play to make regulations and bring about enforcement. Today, the Metro Plant is the 10th largest of its size in the nation. It treats 65% of the region's wastewater and is recognized for high performance, sustainability, and affordability. The second chapter in our history is the creation of the regional wastewater treatment by the legislature in 1969, when several communities supported the regional concept as a solution to the situation of 35 different wastewater treatment facilities operating in the region and struggling to meet their performance requirements and to have the financial resources. This created the opportunity to serve the region with a much smaller number of facilities that were built with high performance design and technology. With the gained efficiency, resources were able to be focused on improving the quality of the treated discharge to the waters of the region and ensuring that we had the capacity to support the growth of communities. The third chapter sets us apart again from other regions who today still have combined storm and wastewater sewers, and with rain events, they send sewage to the receiving water body. Our system, on the other hand, treats 100% of the wastewater flow because the region supported separating the storm and sewage system in 1985. Doing this work was a big undertaking, but the cost and the availability of federal dollars in the 80s stands in stark contrast to the reality today for utilities who still have combined sewers and are having consent decrees in the billions. All three of these chapters on bringing focused on bringing better protection of the public health and the environment, and they also were a financial success that's led to our costs being 40% lower than similar-sized utilities in our national peer group. This truly is a partnership with the communities in the region. It starts with the underground infrastructure. Our wastewater system is interconnected with each community's local infrastructure, which connects to the homeowner or the business pipes. There's a lot of pipes in this region. Specifically, there's 7,500 miles of privately owned service laterals that connect homes and businesses to 5,000 miles of community-owned sewers, and then to our 610 miles of interceptors that relay that to one of our 8 wastewater treatment plants. Our customers are our communities, and they're also our partners in operating and maintaining the region's wastewater system. As you can imagine, the undesirable impacts if either partner fails to keep their parts of the system in good working condition. An unfolding important chapter in the success of the regional partnership is the inflow and infiltration program, which began in 2007. This program was shaped by a task force made up of communities across the region, working with a shared understanding of the problem and the consequences of not addressing cracked and failing pipes. There has been $15 million invested annually to reduce the inflow and infiltration. We are seeing the improvements, and this reduces the pressure to expand the wastewater system capacity. This medley of graphs on this page are showing that the population has grown and the average annual rainfall has increased. Both would normally raise the flow in our system, but you can see our flow has decreased. Water conservation is one factor in that reduction, but we can demonstrate that inflow and infiltration is also a driver in that reduction. MCES is a wholesale provider of wastewater services. We do not rely on taxes. The graph shows our anticipated revenues for next year, 2019. 77% of our revenue comes from a use charge that each year we charge to municipal wastewater, to the municipalities for their wastewater treatment. 4% is from the industrial users, and 15% of our revenue comes from new connections called the sewer availability charge, which is for capacity that was built into the system that they are now going to sign up to use.
Ms. Thompson, if I can interrupt for a moment, we've got a couple questions.
So, sure.
First, Representative Wagenius, and then Representative Fisher.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. There's been some literature lately about the emissions of PFOAs and PFOSs from wastewater treatment plants, and one of the concerns was land applied sludge testing for PFOAs and PFOSs. So my question is, do you land apply sludge? Do you test for PFOAs and PFOSs? And do you test your effluent for them too?
Ms. Thompson.
Mr. Chair, I'll try and remember all of the aspects of that question. If not, we can come back. So, yes, we do some land application. We have two facilities that do biosolids land application. And we do all the testing required by the PCA. I do not, off the top of my head, know which of those are requiring testing for PFOAs, but we can be happy to get you that information. Same way with our effluent. We do test for that in our effluent. I know that. I'm just not sure of all the things in the biosolids piece. I'm fairly confident it's tested, but I'd want to make sure they got you the actual facts.
Representative Wagenius.
Yes. It's good that we can hear about what's in the biosolids. What's the standard we use for how much we allow out in water?
Ms. Thompson.
I don't know the number off the top, but it's lower than what the drinking water standard was. At the last time we renewed our metro permit, it was lower than the drinking water standard for that. I can add one other element because I see your line of concern. The Metro Plant is our largest facility, and we are doing research with the university at this time where they were incinerating our solids as opposed to land applying them. But the incineration is a very, very high temperature, and we're finding that that might be able to be directly used or land applied and as a good source of phosphorus, but without some of the issues of traditional biosolids. So we're still, you know, doing the research piece, but this looks like it could be a promising better way to deal with that and still recover what's elements within there that we do not want to lose.
Thank you.
Representative Fisher.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. The question I have is going back towards your infiltration is you talk about water getting into the system. What I'm a little curious on is how do you deal with the acid issue when you've got problems with leaks in the system and some water coming in, you've got raw sewage that leaks out. How do you detect those? How do you address that type of situation?
So that hasn't presented as a problem. The nature of water and how it seeks escape routes. There isn't pressure within the pipe. The pressure is in the outside of the pipe, so it tends to want to infiltrate in as opposed to leaking out. Now, if you had a horribly conditioned pipe, you could see probably the opposite, but we, as part of our capital program, which I'll go through, we always do condition assessments of our pipes and make sure that those are in good shape. And we're fairly confident that communities that have their pipes in the communities are doing what they can as well because they don't want to be paying for flow that doesn't really need to be treated, and they want to protect their public as well.
Representative Fisher.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And where I'm thinking, too, is not just the regular pipes where you might have the pressure on the outside, but I know that there are forced mains where it's piped under pressure. In that case, the pressure in the pipes I could see would be much greater than the pressure outside, and that to me is where you could have quite a bit more raw sewage flowing out. And I know there have been failures on the system in the past that have caused problems. And so just wondering, how do you keep an eye out and protect not just the diligence? You do a lot of diligence on the inflow, but what kind of diligence are you doing to help make sure that you're staying ahead of those outflows?
Ms. Thompson.
Mr. Chair, we have stepped up in recent years our proactivity in terms of assessing the pipes. And that means the frequency in which we evaluate them. We rate them on a 1 through 5, and if they're as bad as a 3, they're on a program improvement. And if they're a 4 or 5, we're dealing with them right away. We tend to have a pretty good prediction based on the age of those pipes, but sometimes conditions and materials don't live up to the models and their usual. So where we discover that it's a material or situation, we pay extra attention to. But we think that's also important for us. If we're all going to make I&I better, we have pipes too. And we want to do our part to make sure that we're not building additional plant capacity unnecessarily.
Ms. Thompson, just to follow up on that, do you know if there are communities that still have like wood banded pipes where they're, or do we have those all been replaced?
I do not know, but I can certainly get that information to you. My expert in that area was here earlier this week, but they're out of town for a conference at this time, so they're not with me. But we can get you that information.
And then as a follow-up to Representative Wagenius's question, some new literature has looked at the impact of plastics and the biosolid application. And have you or has anybody else looked at when you're applying sludge, how much plastic is going on in the landscape, which may then float off with heavy rain or snow melt and then end up back in rivers? Has there anything been done on plastic pollution?
Not by us directly. I'm pretty sure we've looked at the research and the data. Again, I think we could provide you some good response in terms of what we're seeing in our situation.
I think we may revisit that. Any other questions? I'll proceed.
Well, that was a great segue to our capital program and taking care of our pipes. We spend a fair amount of money, as you can see here, to preserve our assets, $7 billion of infrastructure. 79% of that is to preserve that pipe to make sure they're carrying and conveying that flow. There's a 12% that's gone towards serving growth of the region, so it's a pretty small growth. Is tended to stay within the boundaries of where we already have infrastructure. And 9% is to improve quality, and that a big driver of that, of course, is the very things that we were just talking about. What kinds of things are we measuring and finding out is a problem in the wastewater flow that we need to maybe do some different treatment approaches for addressing? Shifting now to our water resources planning responsibility. In our water supply and water resource planning roles, we work with regional partners to develop and update a regional water supply plan and then their watershed management plans. So this work really includes supporting the local government units, helping them make informed and effective decisions, giving them assistance in developing their plans and meeting their goals, as well as in some cases, doing some research about possible solutions and helping them to find the best solution going forward. This is all built around a trust model. So they're not our customers in this case, but we think they're our important partners in a collaborative approach. And we want to be as transparent with our stakeholders and connect with them in a meaningful way. So to that end, we've had in our history a Metropolitan Area Water Supply Advisory Committee. But in the last few years, we've also added a technical advisory committee to support them with staff from the cities that have a little bit more of the nuts and bolts aspects and practicality of things. And then even further than that, we are now supporting over 50 communities who've gotten involved in on 9 ongoing sub-regional groups to tackle the unique water challenges, because they tend to vary depending upon the aquifer and their population and their water supply source. All those things create a different mix. This work depends on clean water funds to identify local water supply risk, help communities develop options that work for their needs and make the best use of the water resources. And the funding request for this biennium is $2 million for local community water sustainability work and $1 million for local water use efficiency grants. This is the Metro plant today, much bigger than it was when it was built back in 1938 at $16 million. And with that, I'd be happy to answer any other questions that you might have.
Any questions? Representative Sandell.
Mr. Chair, thank you. I have a couple of questions here. I know that the Pollution Control Agency and the Health Department have a working committee on issues related to the 3M settlement. I wonder if DNR has representation on that committee.
Or Met Council.
Mr. Chair, the Department of Natural Resources is actively involved in that, and we are active as asked. So we're not providing a leadership role in that, but we have been involved for very specific things.
Thank you. Thank you. I'd like to talk a little bit more about that. Mr. Chair, I have another question as well. I noticed that the industrial waste charges are only 4% of your revenues. I was a little surprised at that, I guess, maybe because I'm not very knowledgeable in the area, but I wondered if that doesn't sound awfully low, particularly considering the issue that we face in the southeast metro area with 3M.
Ms. Thompson.
Mr. Chair, we have 800 industries that we permit, and their fees are based on flow as well as strength charge. So they pay in parity with what homeowners pay, because we base the strength based on the difference that they're giving us versus what a typical homeowner would provide. And if there's something that we can't remove, we tend to not let them give it to us. And the other thing is, we've worked with a lot of our industries to help them develop within their manufacturing, and that's it's actually in a partnership with the U as well, ways to reduce their water use, which sends us less water. So there's also been conservation efforts going on with the industries, which reduces their costs.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just one more question. I understand that as new housing developments are put in around the cities, unless that development has more than 250 residences, no environmental impact statements are required. I understand there's something called an environmental worksheet. Is that correct? And if it is, are you getting enough information from the environmental worksheet, and are you being able to make satisfactory preparations and defense against growing issues of pollution and wastewater problems?
Ms. Thompson.
Mr. Chair, if it's okay, I'd like to hand that off to my partner here, who is more directly involved with that part of the process.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, committee members. I'm Lisa Barajas. In community development, we review all of the environmental documents that are prepared for the metro area, including environmental assessment worksheets and environmental impact statements. And you're right, there is a different threshold for the metro area, because we do comprehensive planning for all the communities in the metro area. So we know what communities are planning for. They're telling us where development is going to happen, when wastewater will need to be provided to them within these decade time frames, and then we're tracking along with them as development gets permitted. So it's those higher thresholds for development that we're seeing for environmental assessment worksheets and EISs. Those provide a significant amount of information for us, and we really appreciate the level of detail that we get in that, because it does help us to have a conversation with local governments about those developments where if we have questions, then we can have a conversation about how we make that work, how we can ensure that they have the appropriate amount of service when they need it. So if we need to program some capital improvements or move them up in our timeline to help support that we're having that dialogue together. It also helps us to assess whether natural resources in the area are being protected as part of that development process as well, and to coordinate our technical expertise with their local development.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you.
And Representative Eklund, I'm going to ask if we can hold for just a little bit to proceed through, because we're running a little bit late.
Okay.
So if Ms. Barreras, if you want to, and then we'll get to your question.
Thank you, committee members. I'm Lisa Barajas. As I mentioned, I'm the Community Development Director at the Metropolitan Council. I'm going to focus on just regional parks today and not the whole of the work we do in my division. So a different system at the council, probably more visible, and one might argue a more beautiful system, but beauty's in the eye of the beholder. In 1974, the state legislature found that the pressures of urbanization and development threatened valuable recreational open spaces in the metro area. And at the same time, the need for such areas was increasing with the growing population. Therefore, immediate action was necessary to provide funds to acquire, preserve, protect, and develop regional recreation open space for public use. This led to the 1974 Metropolitan Parks Act, which established the regional park system. That act directed the council to develop the regional parks policy plan that would identify land, which together with the state's parks and trails would reasonably meet the outdoor recreational needs of the people of the metro area. The act also establishes criteria and priorities for the allocation of funds for the acquisition and development of those lands. So the Metropolitan Council leads the planning of the Metropolitan Regional Park System with 10 regional parks implementing agencies, and you can see their jurisdictions on this map in front of you. The council is charged with the long-range planning, as well as serving as the fiscal agent for the system as a whole. We do not actually own or operate the Metropolitan Park System ourselves. That is done by our parks implementing agencies. As a fiscal agent, the council passes through 100% of the state funds directly to our 10 implementing agencies. We do not keep a single penny of the state funding for regional parks. Some might do that for administrative fees, but we do not do that. In addition, the council matches state funding with millions of our own regional bonding dollars. Here you can see the regional park system components that we have open today. The regional park system is based on protecting natural resources, habitat, and water quality. It's focused on water bodies in particular, lakes, rivers, and streams, and it provides passive recreation opportunities, picnicking, hiking, birding, swimming, etc. And often the regional park system components cross city boundaries and provide recreation and open space opportunities that local communities may not be able to provide on their own. So we currently have over 54,000 acres of parkland open in the metro area with 389 miles of regional trails that are connecting those parks together. Our plan is to expand our system to meet the growing needs of our growing population, and that would include over 70,000 acres of parkland and 1,100 miles of regional trails. That's really where the bulk of our work will be, is in expanding the regional trail system to help connect residents to those parks and connect the parks to one another and truly make that a system. There are four types of units within our metropolitan park system, as you can see on the slide. These opportunities really make the regional park system a true gateway to Minnesota's amazing outdoor recreation opportunities and connect folks in addition to federal, state, and greater Minnesota parks. There's three distinguishing characteristics of our regional parks as compared to local parks. Ours are, by definition, nature-based resources, providing opportunities, like I mentioned before, for passive recreation. So you won't find softball fields or basketball courts in a regional park. Instead, those are in cities and other local parks. Regional parks tend to be very large in size, anywhere from 100 acres to 5,000 acres in size. And they draw a significant portion of their visitation from a regional audience and outside of their political jurisdiction. The system serves the whole region as well as state and beyond. As you can see on this chart, you can see the usage from around the state, and it breaks down local visits and regional visits as well. So you can see while most of the visits to our regional parks are local in that visitors are coming from that jurisdiction's actual area. So if a Ramsey County park is, that would be a Ramsey County resident, for example. We also have significant visitation from others who live outside of that jurisdiction, so someone from Scott County going to visit a Ramsey County park, for example. And in addition, about 5% of our total visitation comes from greater Minnesota and outside of Minnesota. As you can see on this chart, the regional park system is also well-loved. During the most recent 2017 visitation survey, the system had over 58 million visits. When the system was created in 1974, there were an estimated 5 million annual visits to the system. But by 2015, the Minneapolis Chain of Lakes Regional Park alone had 5 million annual visits as a whole. And then overall, as you can see, we're at over 58 million visits. We see this trajectory continuing to go up as our region's population continues to grow and as our system continues to get built out, particularly in connecting the regional trail system to residents as well as connecting the parks to one another. And to quickly close out, the council administers the regional parks grant programs that provide funds for both the operations and maintenance and the acquisition and development of the regional park system. As you can see on this graphic, all four of our grant programs are sourced through state funds, several of which are distributed by formula that's detailed in statute. You can also see that the council provides regional bonds that match as a match in three out of four of these grant programs. We currently have 150 active grants that total $120 million. Our implementing agencies are very active in their acquisition process, always looking for opportunities from willing sellers to add those lands to the system. So with that, I would be happy to take any additional questions you might have, understanding I know that you have other items on your agenda today. Thank you.
Thank you. Representative Eklund.
Thank you, Ms. Chair. And this may have worked out hearing about the parks anyway for my question. So my question is, last year when I was down here, I saw a report that the salinity in the water in the Twin Cities area and the Seven County Metro is of great concern, and that possibly within a decade it will not be able to sustain life as the lakes have right now. What does the Met Council have a plan to address this, and if so, where are you at on it?
Ms. Thompson.
Mr. Chair. We have engaged some of our partners in the region to suggest that we should come together in a collaboration, looking at all aspects of that issue, so that we can find best path forward, because we know that worst case for us would be that we'd have to treat and take out chlorides out of our wastewater, which is a reverse osmosis process, would be very expensive. But that doesn't help the lakes where the stormwater is flowing off still. So it does take, I think, a multi-stakeholder look at trying to find the best paths forward. And so we don't really own that, but we are trying to catalyze something to happen as a collaborative effort.
Representative Eklund.
Thank you, Ms. Chair. Well, I appreciate that. I'd like to see where you're at on engaging the stakeholders, because there's a lot of groups that like to put their fingers in what's going on in northern Minnesota, where I'm from, and we'd kind of like to see the same attention down here in the Twin Cities. Thank you.
Any other thing for Met Council? Representative Fabian.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I see that you've expanded your trail system by 29 miles from last year's presentation. And last year I asked a question of the 360 miles last year. Now this year it's 389 miles. How many miles of ATV and snowmobile trails do you have available?
Mr. Chair, committee members, we our regional trail system is for general recreational use, so generally walking and biking. It's not for motorized access. We don't have currently a plan to do that. I'd have to look at our direction from our regional parks agencies to do that. From time to time, some of our agencies do consider different types of access within their park facilities, but the trails that we are part of the regional system are connect unit to unit, are not for motorized access.
Representative Fabian.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Well, I would encourage you to take a harder look at that. I know that when you look at ATV registrations and snowmobile registrations in the Seven County metro area, there are literally tens of thousands of them registered, and you have lots of taxpayers who would be interested in using those. And for those of us who don't live in the area but have family and grandchildren and so forth down here, it'd be fun for us to be able to have those opportunities for our grandchildren.
Thank you. I think we have the DNR next, so thank you.
Health benefits for writing a form.
And I know that Commissioner Stroman has to leave in about 15 minutes. Is that correct? So and I'm sure she'll be back again. So welcome, Commissioner Stroman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and committee members. It's my pleasure to be here today, and I apologize, time is short a bit today, but I would be happy to come back anytime you would choose to invite me. Maybe while we're just pulling that up, and in the interest of time, again, my name is Sarah Stroman. I am the new commissioner at the Minnesota Department of Natural Resources. And what I wanted to start with was just a little bit of my background so that you know where I come from in taking this job. I grew up in St. Paul. I'm a proud graduate of St. Paul Central High School. My academic career is rooted very firmly in the biological sciences. I have a bachelor's degree in biology from Grinnell College, and I have a master in environmental management from Duke University. My professional career has taken place in the state of Minnesota. However, I have experience in the areas of environmental education, environmental policy, community development, resource conservation, and with respect to resource conservation, both from a private lands perspective as well as a public lands perspective. I have spent time in the nonprofit sectors, local government as an elected official, both as a city council member and mayor, and time in state government. I am proud to say I've spent the last 4 years at the Department of Natural Resources working as an assistant commissioner with the divisions of Parks and Trails and Fish and Wildlife. From a personal standpoint, I have a very strong passion for outdoor recreation. It's a really important part of who I am and how my family spends our time together. You will often hear me say that in my house, outdoor time is family time, and family time is outdoor time. We fish together, we hike together, we canoe, we snowmobile, we hunt together, and you know, really, for me, there is nothing better than watching my son drift along the shoreline of Leech Lake in his kayak, catching a big bass. At the same time, we also love this time of year to hop on our snowmobiles and take a day trip from the cabin up to Bemidji and back. In addition to my passion for outdoor recreation, I have a very strong interest in engaging people in the decisions that affect them. And a lot of this has been shaped by my time as a local elected official. As a city council member and mayor in the city of Ramsey, I often said that our city's greatest asset was its residents. And I came to find that by working collaboratively with our council and our staff and our residents, embracing diverse perspectives that they held, demanding robust discussions on issues, the city council was better informed and we made better decisions, and those decisions were better understood by our residents, and our community was a better place for them. So these are the experiences that I bring to DNR to ensure the best outcomes for Minnesota's resources and our economy and our citizens. And I'm committed to working with our staff, with our partner agencies, our stakeholders, and everyday Minnesotans, listening to all of their voices. As I'm sure some of you are aware, our staff and our stakeholders represent a diversity of perspectives and values, but we share a passion for Minnesota's outdoors and natural resources. And so I really think our opportunity is to bring together this passion and these diversity of perspectives, the robust discussion to find the best outcomes for Minnesotans. I'm going to share a few slides here. Just to give you a little bit of sense of the agency. I don't expect you to read this org chart necessarily or understand who all these people are, but what I want to share is just how our agency is structured. In addition to the commissioner, we have a deputy commissioner. We have four regional directors, three assistant commissioners then that provide policy and directional oversight for seven divisions, six programmatic divisions, one operational division. In addition, we have a general counsel. We have a special assistant to the commissioner for public engagement. We have and then sort of dotted lines from the commissioner's office to our chief financial officer, our communications director, and our HR director. So that gives you a little bit of sense of how our leadership team is structured. One of the things that you will all come to know about.
Mr. Chair.
Yes.
Representative Fabian.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Commissioner Strobin, thanks for being here today. Appreciate your passion. Your organizational chart, is that any different than it was presented 2 years ago or 4 years ago?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Fabian, it is largely the same. What I will tell you, there are some maybe minor differences. The way the assistant commissioners are structured in terms of the divisions they will oversee has been changed. So in particular, the Operations Services Division over the last administration reported directly to the deputy commissioner. That is now going to report to an assistant commissioner along with the six other divisions. And the suite of divisions that go to an assistant commissioner have been changed a little bit. Some of the dotted line relationships have been changed. For example, the communications director will have a dotted line relationship to the deputy commissioner instead of the commissioner. But largely, you will see a similar structure.
Thank you.
Proceed.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. One of the things that members who have been here know and members who are new will come to know is the DNR has a large footprint in terms of our own staff. We're divided into four regions. As I mentioned earlier, we have four regional directors. We have more than 300 work sites statewide, and we have recreational facilities in every county in Minnesota. We employ 4,300 people, and we own or lease 2,900 buildings. In terms of our external footprint, what you will notice is we touch a lot of people. We have 1.7 million anglers in Minnesota. We have anglers, hunters, and trappers. We have 10 million visitors to state park and recreation areas. We have more than 800,000 registered boats and nearly 200,000 registered snowmobiles, as Representative Fabian referred to earlier, and 300,000 registered ATVs. There are a lot of people who are out throughout the state recreating. And they're using a lot of lands and trails and recreational facilities that we manage, again, throughout the state that touch, I can guarantee you, every one of your districts. And I'm not going to go through all the numbers. You can see them there. For those of you who are not familiar with the DNR's mission, it is a broad mission. It's a three-part mission. Our mission is to work with citizens to conserve and manage the state's natural resources, to provide outdoor recreation opportunities, and to provide for commercial uses in a way that creates a sustainable way of life. This mission then drives the four primary goals for the agency. Goal number one, that Minnesota's waters, natural lands, and diverse fish and wildlife habitats will be conserved and enhanced. Number two, Minnesota's outdoor recreation opportunities meet the needs of new and existing participants so that we all feel connected to nature. Number three, that Minnesota's natural resources contribute to strong and sustainable job markets, economies, and communities. And then four, that the DNR demonstrates operational excellence and continuous improvement in service to citizens of Minnesota. What this translates into is then specific work that we do. And I think over the next 4 years, there's no doubt there is a lot for us to work on. As we know, we continue to lose important prairie and grassland and wetland habitat. Our mining and forest products industries that are critical to our state's economies face both cyclical and systemic challenges. We still have far too many waters that are not fishable, swimmable, or drinkable. We sometimes struggle to meet both current and future water needs in a sustainable way. We have invasive species issues, both terrestrial and aquatic. Those species continue to spread. I know this committee has had discussion about the disease threat that is currently facing Minnesota's deer herd. And frankly, the foundation of conservation funding is on shaky ground. Going forward, we'll address these issues and we'll build on the accomplishments of the last 8 years. Couple things I just want to mention. We have already signed a memorandum of understanding recommitting to the Pheasant Action Plan. We have signed a memorandum of understanding with the Board of Animal Health to work on CWD issues more effectively together. And we'll continue to work on updating our CWD response plan to ensure not only the health of Minnesota's deer herd, but also the health of Minnesota's deer hunting experience. We'll continue to engage with local partners like the Sand Hill River Watershed on projects that create habitat or manage habitat. We'll continue to work with landowners and businesses to ensure they can conduct important economic activities in a way that also protects Minnesota's resources. And we'll continue to enhance and offer unforgettable experiences at Minnesota state parks, trails, and our recreation facilities. I'll just leave you with one thought. If you probably heard this theme, it really is my goal over the next 4 years to strengthen connections between all Minnesotans and our outdoor resources by offering diverse and world-class outdoor recreation opportunities. It is also my goal to ensure that people see and feel the connection between our work at DNR, whether that work is issuing a permit or it's putting out a dock for a boat access, that they understand the connection between the work that we do at DNR and Minnesota's quality of life. And Mr. Chair, I'll leave it at that, and hopefully we've saved a few minutes for questions before I have to leave, and then Mr. Meyer and Ms. Robison will be here to offer some additional information and answer questions as well.
Thank you, Commissioner. There's at least three questions, but before I get to those, I want to thank you for being here, but also if you could relay a thank you to all of the staff at the Department of Natural Resources for the work that they do for the people of Minnesota. When it's a cold day like this, we know there are folks that are out working for Minnesota, and we want to express our thanks to those workers who sometimes we may not think about but have an expectation that they're working. So thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Appreciate it, and I will pass on that.
Thanks. We have Representative Green, then Representative Lee, and then Representative Fabi.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Commissioner, welcome to the committee. I have a couple questions for you. Do you know today an updated list for us or amount of acreages that the state and federal government holds in Minnesota?
Mr. Chairman and Representative Green, I'm going to defer that question to Mr. Meyer. I believe he can answer that when he comes
down. Okay. I'll wait for Mr. Meyer to come down. But then the other thing is you'd mentioned that, you know, we have a steady loss of wetlands, but every year the state buys more land in Minnesota, and it's getting to be a problem for us in greater Minnesota. Can you tell me how much wetlands were lost in 2018?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Green, I can't give you the exact amount for 2019. What I can tell you is it continues to be an issue, and I think by way of example of the impacts of that, we are seeing particularly in the southern part of the state where over time, we have lost a significant number of the wetlands that were historically on that landscape. And as we've seen in the past few years, particularly with large rain events, we're seeing more flooding because there are not enough places for that water to go. And so I think, again, we will continue to look at land acquisition strategically. I know some folks here are aware of our strategic land asset management. But beyond that acquisition, I think it's also important to remember the functions that wetlands do. And one of the things I'm very interested in working on collaboratively between the DNR and the Department of Agriculture and landowners in southern Minnesota is figuring out how we put more water storage on the landscape so that we avoid some of these issues that have occurred due to the historic loss of wetlands in that landscape.
Mr. Chair and Commissioner, thank you for those answers. It just spurs a whole bunch more questions that I'm sure we're going to get into over the course of the year, but because of the interest in time, I'll wait with those. But there's a lot of things I'd like to talk to you about as far as those go. Thank you.
Thank you. Representative Lee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Commissioner, for being in front of us today. And it's more of a statement for you, and I'm glad to have heard that you said that one of our greatest asset is our residents. And it is my hope that you as Commissioner will actually get out there and talk to all of our communities throughout the state, and especially to communities like mine where there are some barriers for our constituents and getting out there to access our resource. And one example that I hear every single day from our residents, even though we have the Mississippi River right next to my district, it is so hard for them to get out there to even enjoy that, to be able to be on the river or to even fish. And so I hope that you'll be able to travel throughout the state and engage with all of our constituents to really see how we can make our natural resources more available for all of them, too. Thank you.
Commissioner.
Thank you. Mr. Chair, thank you. I just want to respond to that by saying absolutely it is my goal to spend some time throughout the state of Minnesota visiting not only with our staff but with residents throughout. I as I mentioned, I was a local elected official in the city of Ramsey, and we shared the Mississippi River, and one of my greatest frustrations was we didn't have public access to that river for a long, long time. We finally worked with the county to put in a boat ramp, and I think those are challenges in our communities where we have these fabulous assets in our backyard, and yet we can't access them. And so I am interested not only in finding those opportunities, you know, throughout the state, but particularly in urban areas where, you know, things are so close. You can see them, but you just can't touch them.
Thank you. Representative Fabian.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Commissioner Stroman, thanks for your work on the CWD. I really appreciate your leadership. Last spring, we had a meeting together, you and I, and the Board of Animal Health, and I think that you've been able to create a much better working relationship between the two agencies, and I really appreciate that. And I think we can move forward with some things that really work. Can you make available to us or to me your MOU that you have with the Board of Animal Health?
Mr. Chair.
Well, if I've gotten it already, I apologize, but I don't.
Representative Fabian, I signed it yesterday. Dr. Thompson signed it last week, so it is hot off the press, and we'd be happy to share that with you.
Thank you.
Representative Becker-Finn.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and just wanted to say, I had the same question about how many acres of public land there are, but for the opposite reason. You know, we have Public Lands Day coming up next week, and for a lot of us, you know, we view public lands as those are things that belong to all of us. So every single person in this room, assuming you're a Minnesotan, maybe some of you live in Wisconsin, just work here. But those things belong to all of us. They belong to my kids. They belong to your kids. And so, you know, for some of us, we really see it that way. And I think it's really important to recognize that's true for a lot of folks. And then I was actually going to kind of bring up sort of the same thing that Representative Lee did in just being able, encouraging you to be innovative in the way that we reach out to different communities so that every one of our constituents has real access to those public spaces, because I do think that's what really makes us Minnesotans. So thank you for your work on that.
Mr. Chair, and maybe I will just add, part of the reason I can't tell you the number of acres off the top of my head is I don't count the value of our public land by acres. I mean, I know we sort of report acres acquired, but it really for me is about the values that public lands provide, whether that be recreational value, whether that be an economic value because it generates activity in a community, or whether it be value for water, clean water purposes. So I really do view it as a values thing. I will share one other story about my commitment to involving and reaching out to other communities. Last year, our Parks and Trails Division has a great program called ICANN, and it's a skill building series of classes. And they were doing a program in Fort Snelling State Park with that was going to be filmed for Univision, the Spanish language television station, and they did not have a Spanish language speaker. And so I dusted off my 20-year-old Spanish language skills, embarrassed the heck out of myself to do that program in Spanish. But I share that because I am personally very committed to doing what we can do to include everyone in Minnesota's outdoor experiences.
President Becker-Finn.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And just whatever we can do to help you in reaching those goals, be sure to reach out. Thank you.
I have two more, but I do know that you have to get somewhere. Are they quick? Representative Lewick and Representative Purcell?
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and welcome, Commissioner Strom. I look forward to working with you in your new role. A comment, I do want to work in some detail with the internal EAW process for the DNR, and I've been studying a EAW that's went back and forth for one of the facilities in the district state rec area, and I'm still not done because I get a couple pages in, I get a headache. but a lot of people put a lot of work into that already. The problem is it's not done yet, and it's cost us another construction system. So I I say this in all honesty, I really do want to work. The players have changed now a little bit. Work with the agency to see how we can improve that and not lose in construction seasons because we push paper back and forth between the divisions. But again, congratulations on your new role. Look forward to working with you.
Commissioner?
Mr. Chair, Representative Blewick, thank you. I look forward to working with you as well and talking with you more specifically about the EAW concerns.
And Representative Purcell, and that'll be the last one.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And just to welcome Commissioner Strome. And to Representative Fabian's request on the MOU, would you be so kind as to provide that to the committee?
Yep. Yes. Thank you. Well, thank you. And I think we'll proceed to the next
Perfect,
speaker.
Mr. Chair. Thank you again. I very much look forward to working with you and all of the committee members as we go forward.
Mr. Chairman, members, for the record, Bob Meyer, Assistant Commissioner, Department of Natural Resources. I have with me Mary Robeson as well, our Chief Financial Officer. We'll try to pick up where the Commissioner left off, and thank you for the kind reception, and we do look forward to working with you all and solving some of the challenges that we're facing right now. Just to go back to some of the numbers issues.
Oh, Representative Fabian.
The kind reception was for Commissioner Strowman. So.
I'm used to that.
Assistant Commissioner.
Mr. Chairman, I usually come up here willingly, but I try to get out of here as fast as possible. Just in your packets is a 2019 DNR by the numbers document. Take this and pin it on the wall of your office, and Representative Green, I can get it on bigger paper if you want it for you. It talks about, you might want to wallpaper your office with it. So it talks about the numbers of everything we have, right? The number of acres of land, public lands, mineral rights, payment in lieu of taxes. There's a section on agency operations, and the number by numbers by program. The number of acres of scientific and natural areas, talks about our enforcement division, fish and wildlife division. So it's a handy reference tool for you to hold on to, and I think it does provide answers to some of your questions. It doesn't have information on federal land holdings, but obviously if you're interested in that, we can do our best to get you those numbers as well. So I just wanted to throw that out there for people.
Representative Green.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and Deputy Commissioner Myers, thank you for this. And welcome to our committee. I'm glad you're here.
Thank you.
And I think I can find the federal lands, but if you want to send them all to everybody else, that'd be great.
We'll do that, and we will forward the committee a copy of that MOU, as the commissioner said. Just moving on with our presentation, this might be another piece of paper you wish to pull out and hold for reference. It's kind of our roadmap. The department has a lot of different statutes and rules that provide us with our authorities and our abilities to do what we need to do. And we come to you to work on these statutes and to provide new opportunities when they are needed. But this list of statutes and authorizing statutes and topics is very helpful for you. I encourage you to look at these statutes. This is what we use to guide our day-to-day operations activities of our authorities and statutes and rules. So, for example, Timberlands, Chapter 90 of the Minnesota statute deals with all of our forestry-related activities. The game and fish laws are found in Chapter 97, hunting's in 97B, fishing's in 97C. So if you get a chance or are interested, page through these things and just look at the different authorities. It's always interesting. Some of them go back quite a ways, but it is what we use as our foundation for our work that we do throughout the state. With that, the next couple slides deal with budgetary issues. So I'm going to have Ms. Robeson talk about those, and then I'll come back and we'll do a kind of a division-by-division discussion as well.
Ms. Robeson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. Again, my name is Mary Robeson, Chief Financial Officer for the DNR. This slide provides you with just a brief overview of the DNR's complex budget. Our 18-19 biennial budget is roughly $1.2 billion, but I just wanted to stress to you just how complicated our budget is. As you can see, for example, the Natural Resources Fund, which is about 18% of our 18-19 budget, is actually a compilation of 20 different accounts as diverse as forest management, state parks, and water recreation. Each account has its own specific legal parameters and has sources and uses directly related to the projects and programs that it supports. Similarly, Game and Fish Fund, which is about 20% of our budget, has 15 different funds within it. So within this context, it provides both opportunities and constraints for the DNR. Of course, we have the opportunity to advance our mission outside of the general fund, but at the same time, all of these constraints don't always pay for all of the department's needs. General fund plays a critical role for the DNR in a couple of different ways. First, not all of our fees sustain key activities. For example, with water protection fees do not always cover the cost of those programs. Also, again, it provides flexibility for us in paying for our most core operations. While the general fund appropriations for the DNR play a critical role in our budget, it's a relatively small footprint. The general fund is about 19 to 25%, depending on the year, of our expenditure, which is less than 1% of the state's general fund spend. Also, you'll note in the chart that a lot of our general fund appropriations are either passed through outside of the DNR or are for open appropriations for things such as wildfire fighting, payments to tribal governments, and also payment in lieu of taxes. It's also worth noting how much of the DNR's budget is one-time funding. 32% of our 18-19 budget is one-time funds from the Environmental Trust Fund or from the legacy funds, which include the Lafayette Sam's Outdoor Heritage Council, the Parks and Trails Fund, and the Clean Water Fund. Again, these are one-time funds and not considered part of DNR's base budget. Also, there's quite a bit of money that passes through the various sources to NGOs, nonprofits, or local government entities. This chart provides a history of DNR's actual expenditure from fiscal year 6 to the past fiscal year 18. The lower line that you see over the navy color is a tracking of the general fund appropriations to DNR's operations, and the upper line that is above the blue is a tracking of DNR's total operating budget. Our operating budget in recent years has slightly increased over time, about 2% a year, and general fund appropriations for operations have followed a similar trend. You'll note that above the line, there's some pretty significant activity. The legacy funds introduced in fiscal 10 have increased to about a quarter of the DNR's total budget. Again, that outdoor heritage being a huge part of that. And again, those go to specific programs, and many of them are spent outside of the DNR. Also above DNR's operating budget line in the light blue, you'll see the open appropriations for general fund, again, firefighting, payments to tribal governments, and payment in lieu of taxes, which is about $37 million a year. I just refer you to another handy sheet in your packet, which is this budget overview. This will provide you with a lot of other information as you get to know the DNR's complicated budget, including tracking of our FTEs over time, the composition of each of our divisions, which Assistant Commissioner Meyer will go through, and some more information about our primary funding sources, each of the legacy funds, Game and Fish, and Natural Resources Fund. So, again, a good reference for you as you get to know the department. As Commissioner Stroman mentioned, the DNR does have a very large footprint. We own and manage 2,700 buildings of various ages, constructions, and life cycles. Last year, the DNR finished a facilities condition assessment of all buildings and found that over 500 of these buildings are rated poor and 168 are rated unacceptable. These buildings alone are a backlog of $46.5 million, with a total of $370 in deferred maintenance overall. The replacement cost of all of DNR's assets in total is just under $3 billion.
Mr. Chairman, if there aren't any questions for Ms. Robeson, I'll move forward into the divisional discussion.
Representative Fabian.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just real quickly on page 8, where you've got the pie of the budget by fund.
Yes.
In the Game and Fish funds, and then on about 7 o'clock, it says federal. Mm-hmm. There are federal dollars that go into the Game and Fish fund as well. Can you distinguish those two pie pieces for me, please?
Yes, I'm sorry, Mr. Chair. Representative Fabian. That is absolutely correct. Federal dollars are a huge part of our revenues into the Game and Fish Fund. They go into the Game and Fish operating account. The federal pie chart that you see, the federal sliver, is what's spent out of the federal fund directly. So mostly grants, lots of which we spoke about the last time that I was here. But I can provide you with a breakdown of the federal revenues that go into the Game and Fish Fund as well, including PRDJ.
Representative Fabian, thank you. And thank you, Mr. Chair. Commissioner Meyer, we had a conversation recently about federal funds and how that pixie dust is kind of sprinkled around into some of the different land acquisitions so that even when DNR wants to do something different with that, it makes it extremely difficult working with U.S. Fish and Wildlife. Do you see that there's a chance that that practice could change in the future?
Mr. Meyer.
Chairman, Representative Fabian, what the representative is talking about is typically our land and water conservation funding, which is a federal payment we receive. It's dollars that come from offshore oil and gas revenue at the federal level. The Land and Water Conservation Fund has expired at the federal level. We're looking to reauthorize it and hopefully permanently authorize it into the future. So those dollars we get have specific shoestrings or ties to them. We can spend them on land acquisition. And the problem with that is once we spend these federal funds, we have to have – there are strings that come with those dollars, obviously, and we cannot dispose of that land without finding replacement lands. And we also need approval from the federal government or the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service, Department of the Interior, for example, on other parklands and things like that. So lock-on funding does have restrictions, and it's becoming more and more prohibitive. So we need to sit down and figure out a better path forward to not only use those dollars but allow us, as Commissioner Stroman talked about, to continue our strategic land asset management. There are people who want to exchange lands with the state that we get caught up with approval processes, things like that when we want to sell land ourselves. So it's something we're talking about and looking at and trying to figure out how do you deal with that issue. It overlaps into the Lessard Sands Council, Environment Natural Resources Trust Fund spending and things like that as well. So thank you.
Thank you. Ms. Robeson, these are great charts. Have they been provided to the committee electronically so we can put them online?
They certainly can be, yes.
Okay.
Mr. Chair, as we come back with talking about our budget discussions, we will spend a lot of time talking about these funds. We're in the process of getting individual meetings set up with most of you all to go through just DNR-related activities, but we can provide some kind of 101 background on budgeting. And as we move forward, if there are other opportunities people need to try to understand more or have questions, we can certainly arrange for that time as well. So we recognize our budget is probably one of the most complicated within state government, for sure, probably the most complicated within this division. So we want to spend time with folks, make sure that you understand what we're asking for, where our pressure points are, and what your concerns are as well.
Let's see if we can get through the divisions here. And
Mr. Chairman, and I'll start with our lands and minerals division. This is pretty straightforward. Former Director Jess Richards is now Assistant Commissioner overseeing our Lands and Minerals Division and Ecological Water Resources Division. We hope to have announcements soon on the director. Their main functions are dealing with real estate management transactions, payment in lieu of taxes, making sure we're getting the right information to the Department of Revenue for state land, and then they get the money out to the counties. Our lands record system, as we talked about, the amount of land parcels that we own, we have an extensive database trying to manage all of those records that are there, conservation easement stewardship, lease administration, mining engineering, environmental review, mine permitting and inspections, and also our strategic land asset management efforts are here. I also need to discuss or just present to you our school trust lands activities are housed in lands and minerals, so we have a land asset and school trust land administrator, Trina Zeman, who works very closely with Aaron Richards, director of the Office of School Trust Lands. Aaron Vandeland. And we work together very closely on the management and future management of our school trust fund lands. So, the Ecological Water Resources Division, this division used to be separate as an ecological resources, and then we had a waters division. several years ago, probably 8-10 years ago now. We merged those two divisions, and so we have an ecological water resources division, but it still functions with ecological pieces, and then the water permitting piece comes here as well. Some of the major programs are our county biological survey work, county geological atlas, dam safety permits, water permitting and shoreland floodplain programs, water appropriations permitting, environmental review as well. Our scientific and natural area programs are housed here. Invasive species work, all our aquatic and terrestrial invasive species work, non-game wildlife, and biodiversity monitoring, surface water monitoring, groundwater monitoring. Some of the main customers are local governments, conservation organizations, businesses, landowners, Minnesota citizens who all benefit from the healthy natural resources. Steve Colvin is the director. The deputy director is Ann Pierce, and you can see some of the pieces that they manage, 166 scientific and natural areas, over 11,000 acres in prairie bank easements, over 80,000 inspections of boaters occurred last year from our side from fiscal year 2018. We issued 604 new water appropriation permits in 2018, and they also work with a network of over 1,000 groundwater observation wells dealing with our aquifers. The Forestry Division, Director Forrest Bow is the leader of that division. Deputy Director is Craig Schmidt. Supporting programs include fire preparedness, prevention and suppression, timber management, silvicultural and road activities, forest road activities, forest inventory and assessment, forest certification. We have two independent entities that oversee or look at our forest management activities on an annual basis, and they provide a recommendation or forest certification, certifying that our management activities are the best that can be out there, that the environmental benefit or environmental activities, water protection, erosion, things like that. Also making sure we're reaching out and communicating with our stakeholders, our citizens, and our customers throughout the state. Forest health is a big part of this division. Our forest nurseries are operated out of here. Utilization and marketing, develop new markets for timber, for waste or chips, sawdust, things like that. Site level guideline development and improvement, and making sure that our forests are healthy. Healthy forests ensure the state's natural areas remain productive, ecologically healthy and beautiful in the faces of wildfires, land use pressures, climate change, and invasive species. We work very closely with the county land commissioners in managing the county tax forfeit lands, and also the conservation, the CONCON lands over in the northeast part of the state. So the communication, working with our other entities, making sure that we have not only the latest technology and using the latest in science to manage our forests, but also coordinating across all ownerships and making sure that there's timber in the timber basket for the companies that need that resource to survive. Moving on to our Division of Parks and Trails, the Division of Fun, as some people call it. They oversee our parks and trails, so all of our parks, our scientific or our state recreation areas, our water access sites, snowmobile trails, ATV trails, all of those things. Erica Rivers is the director. Deputy director is Phil Leversedge. And you can see the 66 state parks, 9 state rec areas and waysides, and nearly 5,000 campsites. 1.15 million overnight visitors in 2018. We're doing a great job, I feel, in maintaining our parks while people love them. And they're just a great asset to the state, and it's one of the reasons why people want to live here when it's 50 below outside. Some of the supporting programs are fishing piers, shore fishing programs, and our parks and trails grants programs. A lot of the money that comes in from people paying to do these things. If you're a snowmobile rider, you pay a trail fee within your registration. Most of those dollars go out to the local clubs to take care of those trails, groom them, develop new ones, make sure the trees and the stumps are taken care of, things like that. Moving on to the Division of Fish and Wildlife, Jim Leach, the division director. Pat Rivers is the deputy director. And we're blessed by the activities that we have, or the support from our constituents out there. 1.5 million licensed anglers, over 500,000 licensed hunters and trappers. We have over 1 million acres of wildlife management areas, 1,800 actual units, 61 different wildlife game species are managed, and then just the monitoring, enhancement, and protection, restoration as well of our lakes and rivers and streams are very important. You can see there the work on our designated trout streams, almost 4,000 miles, and then 69 small lakes and ponds, talking about the fishing in the neighborhood program that is very popular within the metropolitan area.
Representative Fabian.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Commissioner, can you get for us, you talked about hunters and so forth, and I know that there's been some declines in the numbers. Can you get us a breakdown by category of deer hunting, small game licenses, duck, pheasant, and so forth, the trends for those over the past 10 years or something like that, please?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Fabian, most definitely. There are some numbers within the yep. DNR by the numbers piece as well, but we can pull together a table for you. I think it's very important to keep our eye on that information. So,
Representative Fabian.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And then along with that, the revenue that goes with those license fees.
Sure. Moving forward, the Division of Enforcement. So we also have a Division of Enforcement led by Colonel Rodman Smith, Deputy Directors, Lieutenant Colonel Greg Salo, 146 conservation officers in the field patrolling an average of about 500 square miles per person. We annually certify over 40,000 students with ATV, snowmobile, boat and water, and firearm safety programs. We've got over 30,000 documented contacts, not violations, but these are our first and foremost method of contact is to make sure people understand what the laws are, they're following them. Usually there's some kind of learning opportunity for people if there is a violation. But we do need to make sure people are safe and the laws are being enforced as well. This is where our shooting range grants were housed out of. So we worked with over 100 nonprofit shooting sports organizations to increase the capacity for high school shooting sports and then recreational shooting through the infrastructure and improvement grants. I should note that the 146 conservation officers that we have now are approximately the same that we've always had since inception. Technology has been greater. We have, you know, better cars, better snowmobiles, better boats, but we also have a lot more people out there trying to enjoy these sports as well. So conservation officers are our first kind of line of contact for a lot of people, and I think they do a great job out there not only protecting but educating people and showing them the right way to do these things outdoors.
Commissioner Meyer, on the shooting range grants, is there an unspent balance in that grant program right now?
Mr. Chairman, if there is, it's about $4,000. So we just did we've done four rounds of grants through funding from the legislature to do improvements for actually create new ranges, do improvements on these shooting ranges. So we have the capacity for the growing sports of clay shooting that's out there. High school trap leagues are just phenomenal. But we did that. We had $150,000 left. We did another RFP and basically got out all of those dollars. I'm not sure what the capacity is out there right now, but I know there's discussion of having a larger state facility at some point in time, and there are some questions about that, but I think the demand is certainly out there.
And Commissioner, when the agency has outreach officers, do they come out of the enforcement division, for example, in southeastern Minnesota? Mr. Froberg, is he out of enforcement or is he out of wildlife? Or
Todd is an outreach specialist with the Division of Wildlife working in southeast Minnesota, dealing with that private landowner kind of first contact, trying to help them deal with depredation issues, and particularly with some of the Amish in the CWD area down by Preston. But we do have regional safety training officers as well within each region whose primary responsibility is to go out, meet with the firearm safety clubs that are doing firearm safety programs, go first face-to-face meeting with people going through the ATV or snowmobile programs, attend local events, making sure that outreach and communication exists both ways. So very important to our success. Our Operations Services Division, as we talked about the number of buildings and everything else that we have, we also have a lot of tractors and trucks and specialized equipment that other agencies don't have just to manage our resources. So this division is led by Lori Martinson. Our deputy director is Andrew Ahrens in an acting role there. And they keep us rolling, right? They keep the bills paid. They keep the lights on, the phones ringing, things like that. manage over 3.8 million total square feet in our 2,900 buildings. As I mentioned, we have over 5,000 pieces of mobile equipment that they manage, including 3,400 fleet items, 1,800 watercrafts, and 12 aircrafts. Operate our website out of here, deal with our public contracts, and then the HR services to, you know, our 43. We have 4,300 employees, but it's it equates to 2,700 full-time equivalents. A large part of our workforce is seasonal, especially in the Parks and Trails division, where over half of our workforce comes back on an annual basis to help us operate and upkeep the parks. So it's very important to make sure that we're bringing our people back, our workers' comp things, our all of those issues are managed out of this division.
Vice Chair Claflin has a question.
Sure.
Thank you, Chair. And this may be a question for Ms. Robeson. Thank you very much for all of these financial documents. As you said, this is a very complicated budget, complicated for us, as well as complicated for our constituents to see where money goes. I had a question from someone who was asking about the trout stamp money, as an example, wanting to know, where does this money go? How do you see what projects are funded with this money? And I'm sure there are other similar programs that are funded that it would be good to know where to find that transparent information.
Ms. Robeson.
Mr. Chair, committee members, thank you for that question. As I mentioned, the Game and Fish Fund has several different accounts in it, 15 in total. That includes all of the stamp accounts. And you can find information on that in a variety of places, including our Game and Fish Fund report, which comes out every year. We also have a citizen oversight committee of the Game and Fish Fund who examines this report and issues their own report of the expenditures every year. So I can provide copies of this for you and for members of the committee. It's also available on our website.
And Commissioner, how do you get on the Budget Oversight Committee?
Mr. Chairman, that's a great question. So it is staffed and run completely by volunteers. We do the office of the back stuff, writing things like that with them. But we solicit applications in the General Register. We have a Fisheries Oversight Committee, a Wildlife Oversight Committee, which the fisheries obviously look at all the trout stamps and things like that, fishing licenses. The wildlife look at all the small game, pheasant, all of those budgets and accounts and provide recommendations. They are interested in coming and presenting to you and having a discussion with you all, so I hope that we have time or you have time to invite them in. They do a great volunteer effort for not only the department but the citizens of the state of Minnesota, making sure that those licensing dollars are being spent appropriately. So that would be a great opportunity that we would certainly welcome. They asked me to try to put a plug in for them today.
Thank you. Representative Lee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Commissioner Myers, I see that you have it on here that there's over 80 million views of the DNR website. I was just curious, can you break it down as to which part of the website are being accessed the most, and considering that the DNR and the state want to increase access for folks who may not have traditionally, you know, been used to our natural resources, are there language accessibility on some of these websites for, you know, some of our different communities here in the state?
Sure. Mr. Chair, Representative, we can break that down to a certain degree as far as the accessibility thing. That's very important to us. While there's some available, not enough. So it's a resource issue that we need to work with. And I know we are working on getting a meeting set up with the Asian Pacific Caucus to talk about diversity, inclusion, how do we get more people into the agency, and that'll be an issue for our discussion as well there. Mr. Chairman, just really quickly, I know we're just about out of time. We deal with a lot of stuff, just about anything that you think of. You'll get a lot of constituent questions for the most part on the DNR, I would assume. A lot of people do. But some of the ongoing issues we have is connecting people to the outdoors. You heard Commissioner Strawman's vision, and I fully support that, and I look forward to working with you all to strengthen that. Fargo-Moorhead Diversion Project, chronic wasting disease, Mille Lacs Lake fisheries, Parks and Trails planning and development projects, school trust fund lands, we briefly touched on that, strategic land asset management, grasslands conservation. The more grassland we can protect, the cleaner our water will be. Mining issues. Timber supply. I know we're working with the industry. Sustainable timber harvest is a big thing out there. And water. Groundwater management areas, White Bear Lake, aquatic invasive species, you know, quantity and quality. Water can be, I don't want to say as confusing as the DNR budget, but almost as confusing as you look at the different authorities and responsibilities that are out there. Our responsibility, main responsibility, is for quantity and protection of some of those resources. So we do all of our water appropriations permitting and municipal water permitting and things like that. And Representative Fisher and I talk a lot about, and mostly our staff talk about water issues in relation to the metropolitan area, which are very important as well.
Thank you, Commissioner. Ms. Robeson. Members, and I'm sure we're going to be hearing more from you later. Members, in your packets is the bill referral memo to the Water Division dated January 29th, 2019, if you want to see bills that were referred to Chair Fisher's division. And with that, the meeting is adjourned with five